Oh, hold up. Smell test. Go ahead. Sniff those pits. Now, your bits. Feet. Toes. Come on. Could be fresher, right? It's all good. Old Spice Total Body Deodorant Spray is gentle enough to use all over your body, giving you 24/7 lasting freshness with daily use, from pits to toes and down below. So every smell test gets a... Shop for Old Spice Total Body Deodorant.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Is it just me, or is Iron Man sounding a little whiny these days?
Nothing's been the same since New York. You experience things, and then they're over. I can't sleep. And when I do, I have nightmares.
That's Robert Downey Jr., of course, in Iron Man 3, one of the year's most eagerly awaited releases. But does Tony Stark have the metal to make our top five most anticipated movies of 2013?
After Iron Man 2, maybe not. We'll also examine Michael Haneke's definition of love with a review of the Best Picture-nominated Amour.
Now, if Haneke were directing Iron Man 3, then I'd be interested. All that and more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace.com's content management system makes it fast and easy to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. You'll find everything you need to create an exceptional website, and they recently launched a developer platform for complete code control.
For a free trial and 10% off new accounts, go to squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM1. That's squarespace.com/film and offer code FILM1. We're also brought to you by MoviePass. See unlimited movies in theaters nationwide for a flat monthly subscription rate. Just go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and enter the offer code FILMSPOTTING, not that long-winded number I rattled off at the live show.
Not the one I had tattooed on my arm.
You're going to have to get that removed.
Great.
I'm sorry. It's offer code FILMSPOTTING. Again, you can use it at moviepass.com/filmspotting for $10 off your first month. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're back in the studio after our 2012 Wrap Party live show from Main Stage on Sunday the 6th. We've got part one of our 2013 movie preview this week, but we'll also spend just a little bit more time on 2012. As you recall, Josh, I lamented during the live show not getting a chance to share all of our Scenes of the Year nominees. I had roughly 27. It turns out I only have six, and we're going to share our candidates later in the show.
The 8.5 hours we were there wasn't enough for you, huh?
Exactly.
But first, love hurts, and so does Amour.
Tout à l'heure, quand je suis entrée, je me suis rappelé comment je vous écoutais toujours faire l'amour quand j'étais petite. Ça me donnait le sentiment que vous vous aimiez et qu'on resterait toujours ensemble.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a? Qu'est-ce qu'il y a?
My appreciation of Amour has been well documented in our Top 10 show and our live year-end wrap party, Adam. And since it's actually been validated by the movie's notable Oscar nominations, it got one for Emmanuel Riva for Best Actress, Michael Haneke for Best Director, and the movie itself for Best Picture. Of course, it also got Best Foreign Language Film, too. The movie recently opened in Chicago, and it's the story of an 80-something couple, George and Anne, whose quiet life is traumatically disrupted after she suffers a stroke. And George, played by the great Jean-Louis Trintignant, insists on caring for her at home. I've praised the acting on the show before, but I want to start our conversation, Adam, with the topic that came up during our Top 10 show with Michael Phillips and Scott Tobias. It was this idea that Amour carries a hint of mercy that's otherwise missing from Haneke films such as Caché or certainly both versions of Funny Games that Haneke made. What I'm wondering in regards to Amour is this. Has Haneke changed his stripes? Has he softened in some way? Or maybe I'm just reading mercy into the movie because that's what I want to see. And is Amour in actuality another Haneke movie about cruelty?
Well, I think we fundamentally disagree on Hanukkah, though I can't claim to be any kind of expert or aficionado on his work. I've only seen four or five of his films, so this won't be a referendum overall on Hanukkah. But considering the movies I have seen of his, I'm going to meet you in the middle a little bit and say it's absolutely a movie about cruelty, or that that's a major aspect of this story, as much if not more so than Mercy and Love, and something that I was more aware of on a second viewing. I did see some of those elements really come through that maybe the first time I didn't see or chose not to see and wanted to find more of that streak of mercy in the work, just like you potentially did. But my question is, why is that a bad thing? Cruelty is just as much a part of the human condition as mercy and love are. In fact, sadly, they're probably more so. And isn't it through careful, rational, thoughtful explorations of cruelty that we define ourselves and find out what we truly are and what we aspire to be? So with that in mind, I get the criticism of Hanukkah as this clinical chronicler of suffering. I do get it. Someone who maybe revels a little bit too much in playing the provocateur. But I don't completely understand it. I don't see how you can watch a film, as you mentioned, like Cachet or even The White Ribbon and even Funny Games, at least Funny Games US, which is the only one I've seen, unfortunately, and not see a plaintive plea for humanity in his work. That sadist label that he gets branded with a lot is lost on me. And there's an interesting auteurist discussion we could probably have about Hanukkah in the response to this film, in terms of some critics I've seen who have chosen to write off this movie because they just see him playing those cruel, funny games again and not maybe willing to see something else in his work, something a little bit more complex. But I don't find that sadistic streak in him, or I'm at least not as turned off by it as some people, and I don't have a problem with this film exploring the cruelty of this relationship just as it does the love that is clearly there.
Yeah, I don't claim to be an expert on Hanukkah either. I've seen about as many films of his as you have, but what's interesting is I have quite a varied relationship with those films. Cachet, I think, is an amazing exploration of cruelty and sadism in a lot of ways, and I hold it up for that. I'm not putting a value judgment when I'm introducing the film on mercy being of more value as a subject for a film than cruelty. That's not exactly what I meant, and I think Cachet is a good example of how that can be done really well. Funny Games, you're right, this is a whole separate conversation. It does not work well for me in that way. But it was still striking to me with Amour how the same techniques, the same formal and craftsmanship techniques that you recognize of Hanukkah are being employed, and yet they carried, or at least the effect was so different for me. I think frequently of a still camera just sitting on a room in his films waiting for something to happen that's often awful, and he's wringing that dread out of us. And in Amour, that frequently still camera is still there, but it just expressed to me something different than sadism. It expressed patience. Frequently, we see Anne sitting there, and she has to struggle to move from the bed to a chair, and the camera waits for her. We watch her, and we get to understand her struggle. Similarly, there are scenes of her quietly reading in a rare moment of peace, and the camera patiently watches her read. These are just very different tones that the same technique is capturing. And I felt that throughout the movie in a number of scenes, and it just felt fresh and new to me. It was just an interesting way to look at Hanukkah as a filmmaker, maybe doing something a little bit differently in terms of tone.
Right. The scene for me that I really think about that encapsulates, I think, for me, this Hanukkah dilemma, this cruelty mercy question, is the scene that literally made me gasp out loud, even though I knew it was coming. This is the second time I watched the film. I believe it's about three quarters of the way through the movie. And at this point, Anne, Emmanuelle Riva, her condition has worsened quite a bit. She's speaking, but you can't really understand her words at all. She's in bed all the time. She has to be bathed, fed. Everything has to be done for her. And he's feeding her, and she doesn't want to eat. And he says something along the lines of, if you don't eat, you're going to die. And she looks at him. That's the moment that, if she did nothing else in the film, Emmanuelle Riva deserves an Oscar nomination just for that look she gives him, because that look says everything. That look says, in such a heartbreaking way, that's exactly what I want. I want to die. Let me die. Stop feeding me. And he, of course, won't play that game. He's not willing completely to let her go. And she spits out at one point, just after this, some water that he tries to force down her throat. And when she spits it out, he loses his temper. George gets mad. He gets frustrated, and he slaps her. And you watch that and you can feel the frustration and you can understand it. And even on some level relate to it if you imagine yourself in that situation, but you also can't help but be totally horrified that he would do that to his wife who's in that condition. And that moment actually follows a scene not too long before it where he's fired a nurse because he tells her she treated his wife so poorly, so badly, and not kind enough. And now here he is actually treating her much worse than that nurse, at least from what we see in the film, ever treated her. And so, as I said, I think you have to acknowledge in that moment that it is an expression of frustration and it's wrong. It's obviously cruel, but at the same time, I think you have to acknowledge it as an expression of his love for her and his desire to hang on to her as long as possible. And it's a very complex relationship, just as dying can be a complex, dirty process. And that's what we see, and that's what I respect about this film so much, is Haneke doesn't try to simplify it or amplify it either. I think it's what you're talking about with the tone and the patience of it and just sitting back and letting scenes play out. I think he lets the process and the performances speak for themselves.
And the real brilliance of the movie and the performances is that we do understand both of their situations in that scene, and we can empathize with both of them. I think this is really put in stark contrast in a key scene with Isabelle Huppert, who only has one major scene. I think she appears later on briefly. But
a Hanukkah regular.
Yes, exactly.
As their daughter here.
And she comes in and has a conversation with George in which she's trying to convince him that he needs help. He needs to bring someone into the house or move Anne out to get more professional help somewhere. And the interesting thing as I was watching this is I should be of her mind because I'm in that generation or closer to that generation than George and Anne's, where you're in the position of the child who feels that the parents are not making the right decisions regarding their own health. And she should be in the right. But I was so engrossed and involved in where they were in their lives by what had come before is that she seemed completely unreasonable to me.
Yeah.
And I think that really revealed to me how much the movie had brought me into their world. I want to get back to the idea of cruelty and mercy and see how a certain scene played off you, because I think it's a good litmus test. And it doesn't really give much away, but it's the pigeon scene that comes near the end where George encounters an open window in the hallway of this really beautiful apartment they live in that has many different hallways and rooms. And one of them, the window's open and a pigeon has flown in and he's trying to scoop it up and get it out. And it's this protracted scene because of his age. He can't move very quickly. He's shuffling and can't keep up with the bird. We're trying to figure out how can we help this guy, and it's that same balance of it tortures us by watching it, but at the same time I came away with how that scene ends with this unbelievable sense of relief, because I think it is an analogy for the journey he's been on overall.
Yeah,
and it was just interesting to me that I came away from it with relief, but I don't know how you felt seeing that.
Yeah, I had an interesting reaction to it too. It seems at first like it could be almost too tortured a metaphor. It could be a little too heavy-handed. The first time we see the pigeon, I think we see it twice, and the first time I remember feeling like, oh, that's the pigeon of death. This is all over. That pigeon flying in that window. There's something about, and I'm really just freewheeling here, I have not thought about this as much as I should, but I remember my reaction being something like, that pigeon, it's a bird. It can fly away. It goes out the window. It kind of comes and goes as it pleases. And you've got these two people, and her especially, who are trapped in this space. And then this pigeon comes in, and now it's trapped and can't get out, and he's trying to set it free. So you can definitely see the parallels. I think you're right, as an analogy to their situation. The stuff I was really wrestling with this movie, and I'm on record here as being a fan of this film and being a fan of Haneke's films, at least the ones I've seen, but I'm curious how you reacted to some of the moments that I think could play right into a Haneke hater's hands in terms of wanting to take shots at this film. I think about early on in the movie, in fact, the opening scene of the film is the door being busted down. And so since this is not a spoiler because it's the first thing that happens in the movie, there's at least one dead body in the apartment. Someone did die. And we go right from that to this kind of morose, grim moment where this door is being broken into and people are smelling something wrong in the apartment to the title on the screen, Amour. We go right from that moroseness to love. It seems like a joke. It seems like that merry prankster that Haneke likes to be.
It's the provocateur.
The provocateur in him. And I would say it's even more blatant after this, after we see that title, where now we've gone back in time to seeing them as a couple before the stroke. And I don't know if you noticed the dialogue, how well or how badly, depending on your perspective, it lined up. But when they come back from a night out at a recital, they see a performance by a former student of hers. They're both, I believe, former music teachers.
Yeah,
and
that
she was
my impression.
A piano instructor. And they come back and they're discussing how their door had been broken into and it needs to be fixed. They need to call someone to fix their door. Sort of ironic, just considering that we've seen someone in the future break their door down. But the moment I really want to consider here is her conversation, her words right after that. She actually says to her husband, "Can you imagine if a stranger came in while I was in bed? I'd die of fright," she says. It seems to me one of those moments, as I said, where you either kind of love it because you love how Hanukkah is being so playful with such subject matter, with such dark subject matter, or you can either write it off as being that shameful kind of provocateur and it being too much on the nose and too heavy-handed and wanting to dismiss it. I could see it both ways.
That didn't really strike me either way, to be honest with you, that line of dialogue. I was more entranced in their relationship at that point, which I think the movie does such a good job of establishing that there are decades of affection behind these two. I was almost more paying attention in that scene to how they moved around each other than how they talked. Because, again, it's back to that Hanukkah camera of just allowing the action to proceed across the screen without cutting around very quickly, just letting us soak in what's happening. And what they communicated there is that he knew how to grab her coat. She knew how to put on the tee or something like that, I believe.
Yeah.
They were clearly establishing well-lived patterns, and that helped to immerse me in their full life together.
Et alors, il a réagi comment?
Aucune idée. Je suis sans doute moqué de moi. Je m'en souviens pas. Je ne me souviens pas non plus du film, mais je me souviens des sentiments. J'avais honte de pleurer. Et en racontant les sentiments, les larmes revenaient, peut-être plus fort encore qu'en regardant le film. Je ne pouvais pas m'arrêter.
C'est mignon. Pourquoi tu ne me l'as jamais raconté ?
Il y a beaucoup d'histoires que je t'ai encore pas racontées.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the film Amour. It just opened in Chicago this past weekend. The honoree of 3 Oscar nominations, Best Picture,
I think
Best
4
Actress,
if you include
Best
Foreign Language.
And Best Foreign Language makes it 4. You're absolutely right. I agree with you. Those moments are where the tenderness and that mercy, if we're going to keep using that word, really comes through. Maybe mercy isn't the right word in these instances, but that compassion and that
warmth,
you're right, of this relationship, because you see those little moments together. And what I think Hanukkah seems to be saying by observing those moments is that that is, on some level, whether we want to believe it or not, what life is all about. It is about those moments with another person where you're discussing how to fix the door and the toilet needs to be repaired and chiding your husband for not turning off the water and you having to do it for him. That's what love, on some level, really is all about. And I think really the heartbreaking scenes in this film that also give us this real sense of that warmth, but also that dread and something really unnerving, are the dances, I'd call them. These dances they have probably at least 4 of them that aren't really dances at all, but there are these instances where he has to pick her up out of a chair or out of her wheelchair and move her to another chair, or pick her up off the toilet, or out of the hallway when she's fallen out of a chair, whatever the case may be. They have these awkward 30 to 60 second, what look like dances, where this old couple is sharing something very intimate, and it seems like they could be almost on a dance floor moving with each other with his arms around her, but you know that's not what's going on at all, that this is a terrible strain on him and a terrible strain on her, and just as warm as it is to watch, that's how uncomfortable it is as well.
And I think that's where you find some of the mercy I'm talking about, because Hanukkah gives us the truth of that. He forces us to watch the reality and the dread of it just long enough for it to soak in. But in almost all of those cases, he cuts away, and I have to think that he cuts away to something else earlier than one of his other pictures might have. I guess that's
maybe
what I'm trying to say.
Maybe so. And I think, too, one of the scenes or some of the moments that really touched me throughout this film were the encounters where they're talking when she still can maintain a vibrant conversation with him. And he shares something about his past with her. And this does factor into a key scene, a very key scene later in the movie. But she learned something about him she never knew. And you think about that. These people have been together, obviously, a very long time. We don't know when they got married, but they've probably been married around 60 years. You would think at some point that there would be nothing left to discover.
Right.
But the fact that there still are mysteries about each other to learn tells you something. It's heartbreaking because you realize that they're not going to get to learn them all. Mm, they're not going to get to learn more.
And
their
you see what an exciting moment it is for them, too.
Right.
So you feel that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so those are those really touching moments. It gives you the sense of the futility of marriage in some way, that you'll never reach that goal of learning everything you can, but also the magic of it, that you have endless things to learn about the person you're with. Another scene that really struck me watching it the second time was a seemingly innocuous conversation they have at one point where he discusses having gone out to go to the funeral of someone they know, Pierre. And in that scene, he just goes on about really the tackiness, for lack of a better word, of death, of how his funeral played out. And I think he really betrays a lot in that conversation, where he gives the sense that the whole thing is beneath him. Everything about how his death played out is beneath him. And that's where you get almost this unknowing cruel streak come through in George. He's not aware that what he's saying could be hurtful to her, that they're going to be going through this process. They've already started going through this process, and she's sitting there taking this all in as he's bemoaning how awful the experience was. And I think that's one of those moments that he's just not aware of. And by the end of it, he is. He apologizes to her. He basically comes to some terms with the fact that he's being unreasonable and he's saying things out of turn. But that lack of dignity in death is something that obviously Hanukkah is exploring in this film.
It's one of the first instances where you see the gulf growing between them, because she, because of this stroke and illness now, is in a very different place than he is. He certainly doesn't want to admit it for himself, and he hasn't yet even admitted it for her.
Right.
And that's where there's this lack of understanding that's really painful to see develop.
Yeah. I guess in closing, I do want to give a nod to some of the people out there that weren't as enamored with Amour as we were. During our top 10 films of the year, we played a voicemail from Callum Marsh, a writer for Slant Magazine. And while I don't agree fundamentally with his take on Amour, it's very smart and very eloquent, and he makes a lot of really good points, and we'll link to it in the notes to this show. And I'm going to give him just a little bit of airtime here. He says, either Hanukkah has attempted to shear his sensibility of trickery and failed to do so convincingly, or he has made an experiment in manipulation and feigned empathy so exacting and oblique that nobody has understood its real purpose. I wouldn't put the latter past him. Either way, Amour intends to dupe us, to feed on our own pain and suffering, moved to tears or scared to death. We all lose our dignity in the end, he writes. And I get that. I've talked about that even a little bit, this sense of a little bit of trickery and dupery and manipulation in some of those elements. But at the same time, I guess I felt enough of that natural empathy coming through. But that's a counter to what you're saying. The way those scenes play out sometimes, that dread that you feel in his other films where it's sort of like, okay, we're just here in this room waiting for something awful to happen. That's how Callum and a few other critics have felt about Amour as well. And it's a fair response.
Yeah, the empathy never felt feigned to me, I guess. That's all I can say.
All right. Amour is out now in limited release. As we said, it opened in Chicago last weekend as well. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
In keeping with Amour, we'll offer an agonizingly emotional and intimate edition of Massacre Theater next, plus the scenes of the year we didn't have a chance to mention at our live show. Stay with us.
Well, don't be a whore.
Folks, we want to take a minute to recognize our sponsor again this week. We're very pleased to have Squarespace back on board as a sponsor of Film Spotting.
Now Squarespace is faster and it's even easier than ever to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Squarespace is a unified service for giving you everything you need to create and maintain a professional-looking website, from domains, design, development, hosting, and support.
Some of the features they offer you are professionally designed templates to make your website look exceptional. Each template has hundreds of customization options available to change grid layouts, colors, over 300 fonts, and more. And you've got a 100% drag-and-drop interface that makes it very easy to customize your website to fit your needs. So if you want a professional site but really don't know anything about code or developing, you can get it through Squarespace. They also optimize your site for mobile devices, so your site is automatically restructured to look great on any size smartphone, tablet, or computer. And their iPhone, iPad, and Android apps make it really easy to update your site on the go and review analytics, monitor blog comments, whatever you need to do, you can do it on the go through their app. And for the techies out there in the Film Spotting audience, Squarespace is built on a cloud architecture for site speed and stability, and they use the latest web technologies, HTML5, CSS3, JavaScript, and JSON for speed and flexibility.
If you're not a techie, Squarespace has great online resources and a support team to give you email support help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This also includes live online workshops for all levels of experience. For a free all-inclusive trial, just go to squarespace.com. Sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out and start building your website. If you do decide to purchase it, use offer code FILM1 and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That means 10% off your first month or 10% off 1 year, which is an even better deal. That's squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM1.
Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
What meds are you on?
Me? None. I used to be on lithium and Seroquel and Abilify, but I don't take them anymore. No. They make me foggy and they also make me bloated.
Yeah. I was on Xanax and Effexor, but I agree, it wasn't as sharp, so I stopped.
You ever take Klonopin?
Klonopin, yeah.
Right?
Jesus.
Like, is it what?
Yeah.
What day is it? How about Trazodone?
Trazodone?
Well, it flattens you out. I mean, you are done. It takes the light right out of your eye.
God, I bet it does.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence in a scene from Silver Linings Playbook. I believe having the conversation there, Josh, that we had the last time you and your wife came over for dinner at my house.
The meds?
The meds conversation.
Yes.
Everybody's got to have it at some point in their lives. And yes, Silver Linings Playbook, the movie much maligned by me, not maligned by the Academy. The
I don't usually like
Academy.
To take the Oscars to prop
know,
up my picks,
it.
But in this case, I'm going to go ahead and do that. See? The Oscars liked it.
There
Adam,
you
come
go.
On.
I think I have my facts right here. 8 nominations, including Best Picture, and the distinction of getting nominees not only for Best Picture, but in all the acting categories, all 4 of the roles, the 2 big supporting roles, Jackie Weaver and Robert De Niro, and then the 2 leads, as we mentioned, Lawrence and Cooper.
Should we celebrate with some homemades?
We should celebrate with homemades.
Let's do it.
Well done, Jackie Weaver. I do love Jackie Weaver as an actress, maybe not so much in Silver Linings Playbook, but we are going to have our Oscar show right before the Oscars. We'll make our picks. We'll get into the nominees and what we think about the big surprises and disappointments on that show. We don't want to dwell on it too much here, but we do have a poll question for you this week about the Oscars. We'll get to a little bit later in this segment. Unfortunately, there will be no Golden Globes talk, at least on my end, Josh, because I didn't see a second of them. I know you were probably very excited, though, to see your guy Ben Affleck and Argo win, right?
You know, that's almost a non-validation for Argo to win a Golden Globe,
come on,
honestly.
Come on, if you can take the validation of the Academy and Silver Linings Playbook.
No.
I'm taking the Hollywood Foreign Press and
okay,
Argo.
You can have it.
Thanks. But I did hear that Affleck had an acceptance speech that was so good, even a curmudgeon like you would come over from the dark side and appreciate Affleck.
I will say that it seemed very genuine.
Okay. That's at least the one thing you'll give Ben Affleck this year.
He gave a genuine speech at the Golden Globes. Yes.
Well, wonderful. We'll move from that to everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. On our big live show, Michael Phillips and audience member Sam helped us massacre this scene.
We never meant to be treasonous, sir. But up there, in the face of that cliff, there is a vast cave. And in that cave, a fabulous treasure of fossils and artifacts.
I've seen some of your fossils and artifacts. They're worth...
There's your minister of science, honor-bound to expand the frontiers of knowledge.
Taylor, please!
Except that he's also chief defender of the faith.
There is no contradiction between faith and science. True science.
Are you willing to put that statement to the test?
Taylor, I would much rather that...
Take it easy. You saved me from this fanatic. Maybe I can return the favor.
What is your proposal?
When were those sacred scrolls of yours written?
1,200 years ago.
All right. Now, if they can prove those scrolls don't tell the whole truth of your history, if they can find some real evidence of another culture from some remote past, will you let them off?
Of course.
Let's go up to the cave.
That was 1968's Planet of the Apes. Plenty of apes to choose from. We went with the original. Directed by Franklin G. Schaffner. Screenplay by Michael Wilson and Rod Serling.
You are a Tim Burton apologist. I hope you don't apologize for that debacle that was the Planet of the Apes remake.
It's not one of my favorites of his.
Okay, well, I should hope so. Either we were too obvious or we truly stumped people on the tie-in because I didn't see a single email getting the connection as to why we chose that scene from the 1968 Planet of the Apes to do on our 2012 Rap Party show. If you're familiar with the movie, though, especially if you're familiar with the ending of the movie, there might just be a connection to a certain Mayan prediction for 2012 that was in the news.
The listeners just weren't worried about that impending apocalypse, I guess.
Apparently not, and that's probably a good thing. Also, though, I touched on it, my theme for 2012, the year for me of data versus instinct and gut feeling, subjective truth versus objective truth, it's all right there in that scene with Charlton Heston playing the man of science, Taylor, versus the man of faith, Dr. Zaius. So that's why we went with Planet of the Apes. Also, it's just a fun scene. I was waiting for you to do your Heston, and it had four people in it. And Sam did a great job.
She was
from the
really
crowd.
Good.
She was fantastic. Thank you for your performance. If you do want to hear that performance and the full 2012 Rap Party live show, you can find it at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. I was really disappointed during the show, Josh, when I asked the crowd to applaud. How many of you recognized the scene? We got like two claps. That was it.
I'm going to blame it on my bad Heston.
Maybe.
I think it was. And what's unfortunate about that is I had jaw surgery. My jaw was actually sewn shut for that performance, and it didn't pay off.
And it still didn't pay off. I mean, you went to all those lengths.
I know.
You're such a method performer.
Exactly.
And yet it didn't really come through. Oh, well, maybe next time we'll do another Heston. The mailbag reflected it as well. Somehow there was a disconnect. Maybe more people need to see this older film for maybe a lot of our crowd. So not many entries to choose from, Josh, but reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Benjamin Tide from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Congratulations, Benjamin. I believe Benjamin was actually at the live show, made the trip from Fort Wayne into Chicago.
Impressive.
To see it. Thank you very much, Ben. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays.
The show must go on.
No, dear. Margot must go on.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Filmspotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
I don't think we need to say much in terms of a hint. I think people who have been listening to the show so far will probably get the tie-in. I'm going to suggest that your performance here may be a bigger challenge than Charlton Heston on the live show last week. Are you ready?
How about Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln? Is it a bigger challenge than that?
I don't know. We'll have to discuss that at a later date, but I can't wait to hear what you're going to do with it. I don't know what I'm going to do because...
Yeah, you don't have an easy role.
No, I don't have an easy role either. Unfortunately, I did practice it briefly today. I practiced a couple lines.
And how are you feeling?
It kept coming out like I was a grizzled Southerner. Which really doesn't factor into the scene in this character at all.
No.
So this is going to be bad. This is going to be really bad. And I started off, too. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You're going to give me the action.
And action.
You want to know why I came back so fast? I got to the end of our lane. I couldn't remember where the old town road was. I went a little ways in the woods. There was nothing familiar. Not one damn tree. Scared me half to death. That's why I came running back here to you. So I could see your pretty face, and I could feel safe, and that I was still me.
You're safe, you old poop.
And you're definitely still picking on poor old Charlie. Excuse me. I'm working here.
I can't help it.
After lunch, after we've gobbled up all those silly strawberries, we'll take ourselves to the old town road. We've been there 1,000 times. 1,000. And you'll remember it all. Listen to me, mister. You're my knight in shining armor. Don't you forget it. You're gonna get back up on that horse, and I'm gonna be right behind you, holding on tight, and away we're gonna go, go, go.
I don't like horses. You are a pretty old dame, aren't you? What are you doing with a dotty old son of a bitch like me?
Well, I haven't the vaguest idea.
And scene. Or should I say, and scene.
That's actually more appropriate.
I love how you got really low there.
Thank you.
Don't you forget it. That was good.
For your part, you were grizzled for your first two lines, southern for your third, and then went back to grizzled. So, nice combo.
If you know what film we just brutally massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, January 29th. You got a little bit of extra time to get your entry in this week.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Thrusters and impulse engines at your command, sir.
Weapon systems and shields on standby.
Dock control reports ready, Captain.
Bones, buckle up.
Scotty, how we doing?
Dilithium chambers at maximum, Captain. Get down!
Shoot. Prepare to engage thrusters.
Chris Pine there as Captain Kirk with his crew in J.J. Abrams' upcoming Star Trek Into Darkness helps us begin our preview of 2013 as we look ahead to some of the most anticipated films of the year. On our live show, we, of course, devoted that entire event to looking back on 2012. The one moment where we got to look ahead a little bit was with our poll question. We asked our listeners and our live audience who they were most looking forward to getting reacquainted with in 2013. So these are all figures who are pretty famous, who have appeared in previous films and are now getting a new life in 2013. Their options were Captain Kirk in Star Trek Into Darkness, Jay Gatsby in The Great Gatsby, Mad Max in Fury Road, Superman in The Man of Steel, or The Wizard of Oz in Oz the Great and Powerful, directed by Sam Raimi. Josh, what did our listeners say?
Even with Raimi's involvement, The Wizard of Oz only got 8% of the vote. That was kind of a surprise to me. Mad Max, also a surprise, 16% of the vote, even though the live audience seemed to be
favored
at the most. Yeah. Jay Gatsby came in with 22%. Close ahead of that, Superman with 23%, but receiving 31% of the vote first place, Captain Kirk.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I think that was probably the closest second to Mad Max. And in fairness, we should probably say that Captain Kirk might have won this poll if not for the fact that there was a little bit of a mistake. As some people pointed out in the poll comments, it looks like now Mad Max, which is going to be directed by the original Mad Max director, George Miller,
right,
but going to star as the lead, the great Tom Hardy, that's actually looking to be a 2014 release at this point. When Sam, our esteemed producer, first came up with this poll question, it was appearing on a lot of 2013 previews. Looks like it's going to go to 2014. So, frankly, ineligible for this poll question. And who knows, maybe some of those votes would have gone to Captain Kirk. But we appreciate everyone who went to filmspotting.net and participated in that poll. Josh, we took one step forward. We're going to now take another couple steps back as we get to this week's poll question. Can't help spending a little bit more time on 2012 as the Academy did announce their nominees for this year's Oscars. And it's easy to rip on the Academy for making a lot of bad choices. And believe me, I could fill about 30 minutes doing it this year if I really cared enough to do it, because I was very disappointed in some of the nominees. But I do think it's probably more fruitful and more fun to dwell on the surprises, to focus on some of the picks that you are happiest about. So we've isolated a few of those here for your consideration. Again, the question, which Oscar nomination are you happiest about?
Beasts of the Southern Wild being nominated for Best Picture. Django Unchained also being nominated for Best Picture. Some acting categories here as well. Joaquin Phoenix for Best Actor, Emmanuel Riva for Best Actress, or Kwangjine Wallace for Best Actress from Beasts of the Southern Wild.
We'll also give you the other option if you do want to write in a candidate instead. And there are definitely ones to consider. A couple I'll throw out there. I was very happy and a little bit surprised, actually, to see Searching for Sugar Man, a documentary I love from 2012 that I was just able to catch up with a week or so ago. I was glad to see that get a nomination for Best Documentary. And Roger Deakins getting a nomination for Cinematography for Skyfall. That film was glorious to look at. Roger Deakins, a brilliant cinematographer, and we just looked it up here. He's been nominated 10 times.
That was a shock to see
that. And never won.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised that he's been nominated 10 times, but the fact that he's never won, I thought for sure maybe he did win for No Country for Old Men, and I probably wanted him to win that year. So who knows, maybe Skyfall will be the one that gets it done for him. Those are other candidates. I'm sure our listeners have a few of their own. Josh, you have talked ad nauseum about Beasts of the Southern Wild. I actually have installed the electroshocker.
I saw that.
So you really can't say the name. I'm guessing that was for you the most pleasant surprise of the Oscar announcement, though.
The thing about it is that occasionally my film of the year has also been nominated for a Best Picture. Doesn't happen often. I think the last case was Winter's Bone, and I knew there was no chance of that actually winning. But this year it is exciting because I think the film we shall not name has a very slight chance, a better chance than Winter's Bone did, of actually winning. So I might have to be somewhat invested in the Academy Awards this year.
Well, it would be easy for me to say Django Unchained was the most pleasant surprise. It was my number two film of the year. So obviously I'm glad that the Academy thought it was one of the nine best. But really for me, even though it's probably not much of a surprise, the nomination that does make me the happiest is seeing that Joaquin Phoenix got a nomination for his turn as Freddie Quell in The Master. That would have been a shame for me if he got overlooked, just as Johnny Greenwood got overlooked for score, just as PTA got overlooked for Best Director, and the film getting overlooked for Best Picture.
See, here you're launching into your anti-Oscar speech.
Now here I am going into my diatribe against the Academy, but thank God they were able to recognize the brilliance of Joaquin Phoenix's performance in
the
film.
Yeah, that was good to see.
That's the one I'm most happy about. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
Mallory, you're in way over your head. I think this through. You've been out of control since you've arrived. You need to cut Hannah.
I swear, Josh, I wasn't looking for an excuse to work Michael Fassbender back into the show, but that does make for some good audio,
huh?
A good transition into our Scenes of the Year nominees from 2012. We are going to stay in 2012 for just a little bit longer here because it was something during the live show that we hoped to get to. Every other category, certainly as the audience had some fun with me, I had many options that I wanted to throw out there. And we did have multiple scenes of the year that we considered. How could you not, when you're evaluating the entire year? If you've been paying attention at all, there should be several scenes that really emerged as your favorites. And we, in the moment, had to really make the call to only focus on the one we chose. You picked a scene from Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, and I went with the scene from The Master. We were just getting a little bit long there. So we thought we would use our time in this segment to share those runners-up. And you heard there, that scene from Haywire, Michael Fassbender and Gina Carano in one of my nominees, the hotel room fight scene from Haywire with Fassbender and Gina Carano, really was, for me, one of my favorite action scenes of the year. Just watching them go at it in that confined space, breaking a lot of glass and breaking the entire room. But really, it's more about the dynamic between them as well and how the scene ends. There's a sly little bit of commentary, I think, there with Steven Soderbergh and Carano and how they end up at the end of that scene. That's all I'll say about it for now. If you haven't seen it, do encourage you to check out that full scene. What were the other runners-up for you? What were the scenes that were really in contention for your favorite scene of the year?
Yeah, I hadn't really ranked these at all, so I'll just kind of throw them out there randomly. But I've been finding myself trying to defend The Hunger Games as a top 10 pick. So let me give you a scene that's part of my reasoning there. And it comes early on. That's the strongest part of the film when we're still in these poor districts and the children are being chosen. Their names are being chosen. Who's going to go into these deathly Hunger Games? And Jennifer Lawrence's character's younger sister, Prim's name comes up first. And this is a wonderful scene in how they get that tension to be so felt. The jumpy camera is used just perfectly to catch faces and the expressions right when they need to catch them. Then it moves on to something else. But there's one quick shot that makes it stand out for me, and that's Prim. Right after her name is called, she steps out dutifully from the line, and before she steps forward to the stage, tucks her shirt in the back of her skirt to look all proper for this presentation. And the camera just gets a quick shot of that, and I love that detail. I also love the elevator's opening in Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
That punchline of the ding of the elevator that's been overused so often in movies, that scene reclaims it because you just don't know what's going to happen every time you hear that ding. The costume parade in Moonrise Kingdom, another beautifully, artfully, impeccably designed sequence from Wes Anderson. The diner showdown in Looper might be the best dialogue scene of last year, with Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt going back and forth as versions of each other.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So do you know what's going to happen? You done all this already? As me?
I don't want to talk about time travel. Because if we start talking about it, then we're going to be here all day talking about it, making diagrams with straws.
We both know how this has to go down. I can't let you walk away from this diner alive. This is my life now. I earned it. You had yours already. So why don't you do what old men do? And die.
Why don't you just take your little gun out between your legs and do it? Boy.
And I did talk about one more I want to mention. I talked about this when we briefly brought up Frankenweenie before, but it's that montage, the depression montage, I called it, where the boy whose dog has died, we see his face and the background transitions throughout his day, going from the breakfast table to school and so on. And the expression on his face never changes. It really puts us in that mindset of depression that's been at the fringes of a lot of Burton films, but is really felt here.
Well, for me, maybe the only scene that just in terms of sheer action and intensity outdid that hotel room fight from Haywire was a scene I don't think you appreciated much in a film I know you didn't appreciate. It's the C-section scene from Prometheus.
You know, that
with Noomi Rapace.
That was a very arresting moment in the movie. I will give you
No more uncomfortable moment in cinema for me all year, so I had to single that one out. And I was also uncomfortable, but in a really good way, watching a scene from a film that came up a few times during our end of the year show, even though, as I'll say again, it's not a film I love, but it's a film I respect and have an interesting relationship with. I'll say it that way because I have such a mixed feeling about it. But take This Waltz, the Sarah Polley film. There's a dirty talk diner scene.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the only diner scene with dialogue that would even touch Looper, even though it's completely different, where Luke Kirby and Michelle Williams are sitting across from each other, and they clearly have a connection. They clearly have some kind of sexual connection, though they haven't acted on it yet. And this is the scene where they finally cross that line a little bit, even though it's only with their words, not with any kind of physical action. And he says to her the things he would like to do to her. She sort of challenges him as if, are you really going to do it? I dare you almost to do it. And he does it. He really goes for it. And I think it takes all of us by surprise. There's a great little bit of acting between both performers there in that scene. Another film I appreciate a lot more than you, but I think you have to recognize this was a really artfully set up and staged scene. And somehow, I don't think it really got any love during our discussion of the film. It's Killing Them Softly, and it's the poker heist. It's the key card game heist in that film. Everything about how that sequence plays out, just in terms of the quiet of it and waiting for something to go horribly wrong.
Yeah,
you just know at any minute it could happen.
There's a bubbling sense of panic throughout that scene. That's
a good
one.
Way to put it. But for me, the moment that actually makes that sequence so rich is what starts it off. There's a scene where Ray Liotta walks downstairs and walks into the heist. And the look on Ray Liotta's face is actually one of my favorite moments of the year, hands down. The look on his face, if you've seen the movie, you know what that moment means to that character. And that look of resignation and that look of just despair, knowing that my life has completely changed for the worse because of what I've just walked into. It's a great moment. I also really love the Molly Malone sequence from The Deep Blue Sea, that long tracking shot in the underground when we get the flashback of this community of people hiding out, trying to avoid the bombs, and having that moment of escape in music and bonding together a little bit in that sequence. I really like that. But for me, the one that competed with The Master and the processing scene, and probably only lost out because I love The Master so much and Phoenix's performance so much, is a scene from the movie The Gray, the Liam Neeson film, the action movie where he's a wolf killer, right, up in Alaska somewhere. That's what he does, is he helps protect the workers on the pipeline. He's a professional wolf killer, and he's damn good at it. And their plane crashes, and there's a few survivors. And the scene in particular for me is the one I'm calling the you're going to die sequence. They've just crashed, and everyone is sort of coming to terms with the reality of their situation. They're trying to assess who's hurt and who's dead and who's still alive. And they come across a guy who's still in the plane what's left of it and is laying down, and he is clearly about to die. He is bleeding all over. He's in a really bad way, and you can tell that he, as you might expect, doesn't want to die, is not ready to die. And Liam Neeson has to confront that with him, confront that moment of just telling him, look, it's going to happen.
Hold on. Look at me. Keep looking at me. It's all right. Look at me. Keep looking at me. It's all right. It'll slide over you. It'll start to feel warm, nice and warm. Let it move over you. It's all right. Let your thoughts go. All the good things. Yeah.
He takes him through it. He allows him to have some kind of respite in his final moments and have some kind of closure almost even to his life. And a lot of films, I don't think, deal with mortality. Amour is one film we talked about in the first segment that the whole film was about that. But in this action film, to have this moment where I kept waiting for Joe Carnahan, the director, to cut away.
To move on. Yeah.
I kept waiting for him to move on because I was so uncomfortable, because it is so discomforting to watch someone in the moment that they realize they're going to die and then actually pass over. That was a hard sit, but one I really respected that he gave us as well.
The Gray is a good film, and I wonder when the last time is that a film released in January, I believe it was January, has been this talked about at the end of the year.
Yeah.
I can't think of another one offhand, but
no,
I did
me,
like The Gray a lot.
I just finally caught up with it in December, so it's one that was definitely a little bit fresh in my mind. We do have a little bit more on 2012 if you are a Film Spotting app subscriber, if you have our Android app or the Film Spotting iPhone app. This week we're going to share something else we left out of the show, our discoveries of 2012, which is a topic I do always have fun with. It's always nice to share with people the people or the directors or the movies that were discoveries, were things that you knew nothing about and now are on your radar and you look forward to seeing what comes next from them. So again, that's in our bonus content this week. You can get more information by going to filmspotting.net and clicking on apps.
Last year, two of my most anticipated films didn't even end up getting released. Who will I curse with this year's picks? The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us. I'm out of the game.
Sometimes, Josh, you just got to pay the dealer, or so says many Film Spotting listeners. That phrase seems to be sticking, and I like it. We'll get to donations and our thank yous here in a moment, but first we do want to plug Jeff Goldsmith and his Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith podcast. No new show this week because Jeff, that lucky little devil, is going to Sundance.
He's at Sundance?
He's at Sundance.
Why are we at Sundance?
That's a good question.
We
I wish
talked
it fit
about
into
it.
Our schedule.
We had a 5-minute conversation about it and then
we
realized
did.
It's just impossible.
Because I got to go to Sundance for, I think, at least 3 years, and you've never been.
Never
so
been.
So I'd love for us to go sometime.
I know.
And we still have listeners out there that are waiting for another meetup, and they're going to have to keep waiting because it's just not going to work with our schedules, unfortunately. Yeah, this year, maybe in 2014. I still even get the email from Sundance to apply for press credentials, and it just breaks my
it's
heart
painful.
Every time it comes out. But Jeff won't have a new show, but he does have old shows you can check out. He's got one with writer-director Joss Whedon about the Avengers, writer-director David O. Russell for Silver Linings Playbook, Christopher McQuarrie, who of course wrote The Usual Suspects. There's an interview with him about Jack Reacher, and there's also a Q&A with the team behind Wreck-It Ralph.
If you appreciate interviews like that, Jeff has also recently launched Backstory, issue 03 on the iPad. Each issue of Backstory is filled with filmmaker interviews. He also has full-length scripts on there, short films, a whole bunch more. If you're a TV junkie out there, Backstory actually ran a full TV pilot script and some video from Mystery Science Theater 3000 creator Joel Hodgson called The TV Wheel, which he actually co-wrote with Judd Apatow and Paul Feig. So you don't want to miss that.
If you want to get Backstory, just type Backstory into the iPad App Store to download the first issue for free for a limited time. And of course, if you want to find the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, just do a search for that as well in iTunes, or there's a direct link in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. One other note we wanted to get to was a plug for our featured music this week from two artists, actually, but one compilation. We got a note from listener Devin Wombold, who says he's a Film Spotting fan in New York, and he's the production coordinator for Artist Den Entertainment. He says, "While I love your show for the movie talk, I also enjoy much of the awesome music you guys play between segments. As it happens, a lot of the artists you play match up not only with my tastes, but also with the lineup featured on the public TV show I work for, Live from the Artist Den. I intend to send on some suggestions to you in the future from my own personal collection, but today I wanted to email you guys about a new compilation album from our show and see if you'd be interested in playing any of it. Our show presents small, intimate concerts with big-time artists in unique and non-traditional venues. This album is a compilation of the shows that appeared on television during the past year, and I gave it a shot. And as you might imagine, since Devin noticed a little bit of synergy between his taste and my taste, Josh, I did like the compilation quite a bit and decided to pull a couple tracks from it for this week's show. You heard Death Cab for Cutie in the first break, and here in this break, a track from Rufus Wainwright. Devin says that the album Live from the Artist Den is available at artistden.com/store and on iTunes. So thank you, Devin, for writing in with that suggestion. Obviously, we did choose to feature your music and hope to check out future compilations. Let's go now, Josh, to our donation segment and say thanks to the listeners who were so generous and donated some of their hard-earned money our way in support of the show. I believe we have five new donors to recognize this week. We start with a new $10 a month subscriber, Mark Dickinson.
Greetings from Kirribilli, where we live in the lee of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. I've listened to your show for a long time, was referred to it initially by my 24-year-old filmmaker son Ben, whom I think you'll hear more about over the next few years. To show my appreciation and support, I've just signed up as a $10 a month subscriber. Thanks must also go to Sam and Maddie and everyone else involved in the program. Film Spotting provides the bedrock of my film appreciation, and I look forward to a long journey with you guys.
Thank you so much, Mark, and best of luck to Ben out there with his filmmaking career. We also got a gold-level donation from Dave Grattan here in Lincoln Park, Chicago.
The Wrap Party was the final push I needed to donate, having been a listener since Film Spotting number 306, but also having made it through the archive to 1 through 305.
Wow.
The Wrap Party gave me my best Film Spotting discovery, Girl Walk All Day. Girl Talks All Day has been in heavy rotation on my iPod for over a year, and the clip would have had no impact if I had only heard the podcast. Attending the party made the difference and will guarantee my attendance at future Chicago events. And Abraham Levitan was awesome.
Abraham Levitan was awesome. That was one of the highlights of the show for both of us. And it's been great to hear from some listeners like Dave, who were really pleased that we shared that little bit from Girl Walk All Day coming into segment two as one of our discoveries. That was a film I saw right around Christmas. When I was home for Christmas break, there were some critics on Twitter who are particularly crazy for it. And I said, okay, I finally got to check it out, and did and enjoyed it. Wanted to share it during the live show. You finally caught up with it too, right, Josh?
Yeah, I watched it after the show. Couldn't wait. Just based on that clip, I couldn't wait to see it. We made it a family event. I kind of asked you about that. Like, this looks it might be good for the kids.
Except for the music.
The music might get a little harsh. And
a little raunchy if they're paying attention.
So, you know, we had sort of an awkward discussion afterwards about certain lyrics. But
did you?
The dancing, they loved. I mean, they spent the next hour and a half afterwards doing those moves all around
doing
the house.
Doing their Ann Marzen imitation.
Yes.
That's awesome that two little girls in Chicago were doing Ann Marzen.
Yeah, they were pretty good at it, too.
That's great. New $5 a month donor, Bill Shun, also here in Chicago.
I'm a relatively new Film Spotting listener. I had caught the show a time or two on WBEZ, but began listening to the podcast in earnest back in October. Soon I was voraciously consuming dozens of back episodes going back into 2010. Your insights are always compelling and your bickering is always entertaining, but best of all are the terrific movies I've already been introduced to that I never would have seen otherwise. Movies like Take Shelter and Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. Even when I disagree with your takes, I'm forced to articulate to myself why I disagree, which helps make me a better viewer and even a better writer. Thanks for making me excited to engage with the cinema again.
I hope my $5 a month donation will do a little to express my enjoyment of the show. Props to Michael Phillips, too. I'm always excited for the episodes where he's a guest, as I told him on the stairs at Main Stage last week before your live Wrap Party, which I dragged my wife to. We both had a great time. I'm a science fiction writer by trade, and for the holidays I printed up a private edition of a collection of some of my short stories to give to a few friends. As an additional thank you, I've dropped a copy of the book in the mail for you. I hope the stakes are high enough for you. That's Bill here in Chicago. And I did pick up our mail at the Film Spotting P.O. Box a few days ago, found the book from Bill. Thank you very much for sending it. I wonder if my son, Holden, who seems to be into sci-fi, would probably enjoy it. And kind of like your question with Girl Walk All Day, I don't know whether it's appropriate or not, having not read it myself, but it seems like it might be. So that might be something to do. Let's get to our last donor, a new Buck a Show donor. He is Mark in Yarraville, Victoria, Australia.
This is a Buck a Show for Adam and Josh and Allison and Matt. I'm worried Allison and Matt could starve if I only gave a buck a show to the mothership.
That listener last week who decided to donate a few extra bucks for SVU.
Yes.
Now I got to send them that PayPal money.
This is becoming an epidemic.
I love it. I love that people have responded so positively to Film Spotting SVU that they're chipping a little bit extra. I will buy Matt and Allison dinner or something the next time I see
them.
Yeah, I'll have to. Thank you for that, Mark, and to all of our generous listeners. Look at you, look at you, look at you. Look at you, look at you, look at you, suckers. Does your mama know what you're doing?
Why do you have that pistol?
Protection? You don't need to be afraid of me. I got two ways to protect myself out here, this shirt and this pistol. There are fierce powers at work in the world, boys. Good, evil, poor luck, best luck. As men, we gotta take advantage where we can. Y'all coming?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh, and just in case you were worried that 2012 was the year of McConaughey, and you weren't gonna get your Matthew McConaughey fix in 2013, oh, he's out there. He's always out there, and there you heard him in a scene from the upcoming Jeff Nichols film called Mud. It played at last year's Cannes Film Festival. It's a movie, Josh, we've both been highly anticipating since we were big fans of his movie Take Shelter, and also his initial film, his debut movie, was one I loved, Shotgun Stories, with Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon also appears in this one as well as he did in Take Shelter.
I think there was just too much McConaughey in 2012, and that's why Mud was pushed back, actually.
Yeah,
we couldn't handle anymore.
You're right. The movie-going public couldn't handle that much McConaughey, but we're going to get a little more in 2013. I'm looking forward to it. In fact, we're so looking forward to the film Mud that we're calling this the Mud Memorial List of our 2013 most anticipated films.
It was going to be both our number one picks,
it was.
Right?
So yeah. So we have called it the memorial pick for this list, and we're going to share our five individual choices for the films that are supposed to come out in 2013 anyway. We don't necessarily have release dates for all of our films, at least I don't, but these are the movies we're most excited about as we finally turn the page on 2012 and look ahead to 2013. Josh, what do you have?
Let's start with a sequel, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For.
Love it.
The original Sin City was actually my number four film
in
2005.
Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the history of Film Spotting, Josh. Maybe you have to do some reading up on this. But famously, Sin City was the first movie Sam and I ever had a heated disagreement about.
Oh, boy.
I really liked it.
Oh, shoot.
I really liked it. And Sam really did not like it. It was the fifth episode ever of the show back in 2005, episode number five.
It blew up,
Yeah, and up to that point, our audience blew up a little bit too because there was some interest in the movie and they liked the fact that we had a nice disagreement about it. So Sin City was kind of a pivotal show for
us.
And I was sure that you, like Sam, probably hated the original Sin City.
No. Now, I haven't seen it since probably 05,
but yeah,
I really went for it. And, you know, it was this explicit film noir. I think it's something akin to Killer Joe, actually, which we talked about this year. Only, of course, it had the bold visual style of the graphic novels of Frank Miller. And this is promising to me because, again, it's based on Miller's work, and Miller is back with Robert Rodriguez as co-director. So there's going to be some creative continuity here. I like that Clive Owen is back. He's hasn't been in much lately, and I really like him as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Mickey Rourke is going to be back, and he really began his resurgence in the 2000s.
I love that performance.
With this performance as the hulking ex-con Marv. You can see seeds of his acclaimed performance in The Wrestler. You can see seeds of that in Sin City, I think. And that's just a reminder that the movie was much more than a visual genre stunt. So the sequel's out October 4. Can't wait.
I can't wait either. And I've also got a pick at number 5 that's coming out in October. And I'm just going to read the description here, because for anyone out there who is familiar with these actors and this filmmaker, whether you know anything about this project or not, all you need to do is hear this, and I think you'll be able to pinpoint it right away. Five childhood friends reunite after 20 years to repeat a legendary pub crawl from their youth, returning to their hometown once again to attempt to reach the fabled pub. Over the course of the night, they begin to realize that the real struggle is not just theirs, but humankind's, and completing the crawl becomes the least of their worries. If that doesn't sound like Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, the guys who brought you Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, I don't know what does. The pub they're going to is the title pub. It is The World's End, set to come out October 25th. I love Shaun of the Dead. I'm also a fan of Hot Fuzz. Even if I didn't really love Scott Pilgrim, there's a lot about it I did appreciate. And Edgar Wright, for me, is definitely one of those directors who, it doesn't really matter what the project is or who's in it or whether he's reuniting with his old partners or not, I want to see whatever he's going to do next. So The World's End, for me, is definitely one of my most anticipated.
Hot Fuzz was a bit of a drop-off for me from Shaun of the Dead, but I'm a huge fan of Scott Pilgrim. So yeah, this is on my radar too. Only God Forgives is my number 4. This is from Nicholas Winding Refn, and his last two films, Drive and Valhalla Rising, made my respective top 10 list, so of course I'm going to be looking forward to this one. Drive's Ryan Gosling stars as a Bangkok cop who's involved in some sort of Thai boxing syndicate, something like that. And while the early images of Gosling's pummeled face seem a little bit too self-aware to me, they're really going for something obvious there, I'm still intrigued. The best case scenario, maybe Refn and Gosling make this something like their Fight Club. That would be pretty awesome.
It would.
This is opening in Denmark on May 23. Don't know about a U.S. release date yet.
Yeah, that's one for me that's definitely on my radar. After Drive and after Bronson, the film that Winding Refn did with Tom Hardy, he's a filmmaker I'm very curious about. And so them collaborating again is something I'm really looking forward to. I'm going to stick in that part of the world generally for my number 4 choice, and it is The Grandmaster. This is the first film in 6 years from the guy who brought us two all-time greats, as far as I'm concerned, Chungking Express and In the Mood for Love. That film 6 years ago was My Blueberry Nights, the movie with Jude Law, Nora Jones, a film I have to confess to having started on an airplane once and never finishing. So
it happens a lot on airplanes.
It does.
It's a bad place to watch any film, let alone that one.
So I really can't judge that movie, but I know generally a lot of people were disappointed in it. And he's not a guy over the course of his career, at least recently, who has done a lot of action stuff. And here he is, this Hong Kong director doing an action drama about the life of a grandmaster fighter named Yip Man, is I believe how you say it, or I hope I'm close. It's written and directed by Wong Kar-wai. It stars Tony Leung, a guy he's worked with before to great acclaim in movies like In the Mood for Love. It's already opened in China just this past week, and it's going to open the 63rd Berlin International Festival in February. But like your pick, I don't have a date for it yet, but it's one people are expecting to come out in 2013. It also stars Zhang Ziyi, who a lot of people will remember from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. She's fantastic in that film, and I haven't seen her recently
in
films that made it to the States or were mainstream anyway, so I want to see what they'll do together, but I really want to see what Tony Leung and Wong Kar-wai are going to do together again. That's The Grandmaster.
My number 3 is Old Boy. Aside from offering the tantalizing possibility of making Spike Lee relevant again, which I would love to see, this is also one of the oddest projects I've heard about in quite some time, and probably the oddest project of 2013. Lee is remaking a notorious 2003 Korean film about a kidnapping victim who's released after 15 years of imprisonment. Now, I haven't seen the original myself, so I've been looking forward to this chance and this reason to catch up with
my number 4 movie of that year,
really?
If I recall.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do that. A bonus is that Martha Marcy May Marlene's Elizabeth Olsen is also in the cast, so that's intriguing. We've been playing with the idea of doing a recent Korean cinema marathon coming up soon, and maybe we could tie it to Old Boy, which opens in October 11.
Yeah, we do have that penciled in the calendar right now, that after the Marx Brothers and after Max Ophuls, we are going to do a Korean cinema or Korean auteurs marathon. So I'm definitely excited about that. That is a remake of Park Chan-wook's film, and he also has a film coming out in 2013 that didn't quite make my list but was an honorable mention. It's called Stoker with Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska. So that's one I'm excited about as well. But my number 3 pick for most anticipated film of 2013, another one unfortunately without a release date, I can't wait to see it, it's Before Midnight. the third film, and probably the last, at least that's what we're hearing, in this trilogy of films from Richard Linklater with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. It follows Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. Like Before Sunset, it takes place 9 years after the last film. And like that movie as well, you've got Delpy and Ethan Hawke being collaborators in the process, really helping with the script and actually being credited as co-screenwriters on the movie with Linklater. There's not a lot of details about this movie out, and that's fine with me. I just remember watching Before Sunset and feeling like, how are they going to follow up Before Sunrise? A movie I love so much that leaves you, of course, with that wonderful cliffhanger moment, and you kind of didn't want to know what happened to Celine and Jesse. You kind of wanted to just know they were out there and maybe they got together or maybe they didn't. It was almost a litmus test for whether you were an optimist or a pessimist, depending on your perspective on love. But it worked. It worked really well. And it had another great ending. So I don't know how they're going to top it, but I can't wait to see it.
See, for me, this is one of those projects where it just felt natural that there would be another chapter because it felt so real to life and you wanted to see what would happen. And it's maybe the rare sequel that does feel natural. All right, moving on to number two. I went with a film you already mentioned, The Grandmaster. I'm also very excited about the Wong Kar-wai picture. I normally don't get excited at all about biopics, but Lincoln's kind of warmed me up to that because it didn't function like your average biopic, and I'm sure Wong Kar-wai is quite capable of doing something inventive with the genre as well. In the Mood for Love, I think you're right, is one of the great films. So any project he's working on is exciting to me. And those responses from China, you mentioned it being released there, have been rapturous. So I'm sure it will find an American distributor.
Do you know this place?
I want to say yes.
Go in there. Just go in there.
For you. I want to.
I haven't slept at all.
Is there a direction that you feel drawn?
I'm going to go wherever you go. You know that.
You're scaring me a little bit.
I feel like you know.
You're listening to Film Spotting, this week's top five, our most anticipated movies of 2013. And my number two pick is a movie slated for release on April 5th. It's called Upstream Color. And this is the second film from writer, director, and actor Shane Carruth. It follows his movie Primer, which came out on the festival circuit around 2004-05. So he has taken a long time between projects. And that was a movie that was discussed here on Film Spotting back when it came out. We were fans of that movie, a time travel movie that's very complex, but also very fascinating, and one of those films that you can keep coming back to again and again and getting a little bit more out of it each time. I know that Rian Johnson, when he made Looper, they've got a relationship. They know each other fairly well, and I want to say that Rian actually consulted Shane a little bit on just making sure everything did fit together in terms of the time travel aspects in that movie. But this is a science fiction film, and I don't know how you can't be fascinated, not only because it's been, what, almost 9 years between films, 8 or 9 years, but then you hear this description of the movie. In the film, a man and woman are drawn together, entangled in the life cycle of an ageless organism. Identity becomes an illusion as they struggle to assemble the loose fragments of wrecked lives.
See, that could go either way.
It could. And I think that's what makes it so intriguing, but having seen Primer and liking that film, that could almost describe Primer.
You put your faith in the filmmaker.
Yeah, you
right?
do. You trust the filmmaker in this case. I'm going to give Shane Carruth the benefit of the doubt, and that subject matter, as vague as that was and abstract, these questions of identity, of reality and illusion, those tend to be films I'm drawn to. So knowing that Shane Carruth is making another film dealing with similar subject matter, though not involving time travel as far as I can tell, but still clearly science fiction, it had to be on my list, and it's up there high at number two. What's your number one, Josh?
My number one is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which
really?
We won't get a chance to see until December 25, so a little bit of a wait there. Yeah, this one's been circulating for years. It's always sounded intriguing to me. It's something of a passion project for Ben Stiller, who stars and directs. It's based on a James Thurber story about a magazine photo editor given to daydreams, and it was actually adapted in 1947 with Danny Kaye in the lead. Haven't seen that version of it. Stiller, I feel, is overdue for the sort of comic drama that he seemed to be heading towards early in his career before he got stuck in museums with urinating monkeys and all that crap he's been doing lately. There's extra appeal for me in that the adapted screenplay is written by Steve Conrad, and he's the filmmaker behind my beloved comic dramas, The Weatherman and The Promotion.
Yeah, that's a film I am aware of, but it doesn't seem to be getting a whole lot of buzz. So I think that's one for you that is maybe a little bit more of an idiosyncratic choice that other people are overlooking, but it's one I'm curious about as well. It's funny because earlier today, prepping for this show, I went back and looked at my top five most anticipated movies of 2012, and sure enough, when we were sharing our top 10 films of the year in December with Michael Phillips and Scott Tobias, I joked that I was so predictable, you could have called it at the beginning of the year that my top one and two films were going to be the latest Paul Thomas Anderson movie and the latest Quentin Tarantino film. Sure enough, they were my number one and two, The Master and Django Unchained.
In that order, were they?
In that order, nice. Actually. So I nailed that. We'll see if I nail it this year with my number one. Almost any year they make a movie, and they do tend to make films fairly regularly, you can pretty much pencil it in my number one slot. That's how much I love the Coen brothers and their 2013 project. It was a film that a lot of people thought was going to come out in 2012, but it did get pushed to this year. It's called Inside Llewyn Davis. It's set back in the 60s, I believe, kind of this Greenwich Village folk music scene. And you've got an actor that we both are big fans of who doesn't really get a lot of acclaim and doesn't have a lot of starring roles, but always appears in supporting roles in films and is very good. His name is Oscar Isaac.
Yeah, I love him.
He's in Drive as the boyfriend slash husband, ex-con who gets out of jail, playing the love interest in that film of Carey Mulligan, who he stars in this film with. She's one of my favorite actresses. But I think beyond this being a Coen Brothers film, I'm really looking forward to see what Oscar Isaac does in the lead role. But you've got other performers as well, like John Goodman, a Coen Brothers stalwart, F. Murray Abraham in the movie, and Justin Timberlake, who I don't always love, but nevertheless, I think is a guy who has a lot of talent.
It's an intriguing casting choice.
It's a really intriguing cast overall, I think. So, like I said, you can pretty much pencil in a Coen Brothers film for my top five most anticipated movies list of any year that they've got a film coming out. And I'm hoping that this one does come out February 8th. That's what I see it scheduled for right now. But that doesn't seem to be completely pinned down depending on what calendars you look at. So I'm hoping it comes out on the 8th and we'll review it on the 8th.
Yeah, it's definitely an honorable mention for me. I almost had it in my top five. There's something vague about the project that could be good. You know, that could be what's great about it, too. But that kept it off my top five. I did have a couple of honorable mentions that I want to get out there, which were actually on my top five list last year, and they got pushed back to this year. And listener Ben Slabeck caught this and brought it to my attention, too. Those were Gravity from Alfonso Cuarón and The Great Gatsby from Baz Luhrmann. I'm really anticipating those two.
Yeah, I think you need to read, though, what Ben says. He says, since Gravity and The Great Gatsby are my most anticipated films of the year, I would hate for Josh to jinx them again because I don't think I could go another year without having seen them. So he actually wanted to call this whole show off before you do ruin more films for everyone out there, but
hopefully putting them in honorable mentions, that'll remove the jinx.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of potential honorable mentions, and rather than list them off here, what we're going to do is we're actually going to make this a two-part 2013 movie preview. Next week's show, we're going to share our top five most anticipated performances of 2013. This is something we've never really done before, but hopefully it will be fun. One movie that I'll tease right now doesn't come up on that list, or I don't plan to mention, but was in my top five this week right up until the last minute, was that film Gravity. When you've got Alfonso Cuarón and you hear about what he's doing with some of the long takes and it takes place in space, then you've got Sandy Bullock and George Clooney just floating out there in space and you wonder, how is he really going to make that a 2 hour or whatever film? That is intriguing.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it really does sound interesting. So Gravity is an honorable mention for me. And as I said, we'll get to more on next week's show as we get to part two of our 2013 movie preview. Those are our top five most anticipated movies of the year. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out wide this weekend, the new drama starring Russell Crowe and Mark Wahlberg, Broken City. Mama, the new horror film starring Jessica Chastain. This just seems to happen that after these actresses get a lot of critical acclaim, it's like Hilary Swank getting the Oscar win for Boys Don't Cry, and then she was in that terrible horror film I can't even remember the name of that followed it, and here we've got Jessica Chastain.
What was the Eddie Murphy one for when he was nominated for Dreamgirls? Was that The Year of Norbit?
I think it probably was.
Same sort of thing.
But here you've got this great actress, Jessica Chastain, in this movie, Mama.
Maybe it's good.
It could be good, and we may in fact see it and review it. So
we might.
Yeah, we'll see if you can talk me into that, but that's coming out this weekend in wide release, and also The Last Stand, a movie, I'm sorry, I'm prejudging, we're not going to see the latest Arnold Schwarzenegger film.
I can't talk you into that one.
No, you can't. And Matt Singer, our friend and the host of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit with Allison Wilmore. He's such an Arnold Schwarzenegger fan. It's probably his number one most anticipated film of the year. And right now he's cursing us for expressing complete disinterest in
this project. Now, wait a minute. It's been 9 years or so, probably, since Schwarzenegger. So how come the 9-year gap isn't intriguing to you for him?
It's not. It's just not.
Doesn't do it?
No, I'm sorry. I think his back catalog of films answers that question.
That's the reason.
And it was pretty rough watching him in Expendables 2. It was.
Now that one I didn't see.
I did see that this year. The Last Stand out in wide release as well this weekend. In limited release opening here in Chicago and select cities west of Memphis, this is another documentary about the West Memphis 3 and that trial. They were eventually exonerated, spoiler alert, for being wrongly accused of killing some young boys in their town, and they were supposedly Satanists, and that was used against them. Great films, great documentaries. If you haven't seen them, The Paradise Lost trilogy of movies, but here's another one, West of Memphis, out in limited release. Next week on the show, this should be fun, we've got a sacred cow, sans Michael Phillips this week. We can't let him destroy our childhoods with Die Hard, but that is our next sacred cow pick.
I think we could just assume Michael would call it an abomination.
He probably would, right? He'd have to rip on it somehow, but we're excited to talk about Die Hard, a classic film, one of the all-time great supposed action films.
We'll find out.
And we'll find out as we discuss that in detail next week on the show. And as we said, part two of our 2013 movie preview as we consider the performances we're most looking forward to seeing this year.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. This week we feature tracks from Live from the Artist Den. Learn more at artistden.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.